Okay, let's get started. So last week we started by looking at the birth. Everybody can hear me? We can all hear me? By hearing the birth of, by reading about the birth of Yaakov and Esav. And of course, we dealt with the, I hope everybody has a Tanakh, please, because I didn't put the psukim on my Mikoro this time. In future, by the way, it's a really good idea for you to bring a Tanakh to any class that I give, because you can always use a Tanakh. Okay. In any event, last week we were talking about the birth of Yaakov and Esav, and we were talking about the differences that are built into them from the very beginning. First, just to remind you, Rivka experiences strange symptoms during her pregnancy. She seeks out Hashem, and she is told that she has two nations in her belly. That's what explains her strange experience, a pregnancy like no other pregnancy. And when the children are born, one of them is Admoni, right? Esav is Admoni, and he is covered with hair. He's ruddy, he's covered with hair. And again, ruddy means that his skin was red, right? He was, like that very, very full, redness of the face. And Yaakov is smooth. And the characteristics here are very, very marked because they're twins and they're emerging at the same time, the same mother, the same father. This is not a Yitzchak Ishmael situation where you have a shared father but different mothers. And we looked at the significance of some of that. And I believe we were left with one last section. Oh, hang on. I have to do that again. Let me do share. And then I share from this section in the birth of Yaakov and Esav. And the question that the we basically looked through the discussion of Yaakov's hand grasping Esav's heel, right? That was the last part we left with. I think we were up to the Ha'amek Davar here. That's what I have marked here on my page. Okay, so let's take a look at the psukim again, the verses, which is Chaf Hei Chaf Zayin. No, sorry, Chaf Hei Chaf Hei, which is Genesis 25:25. Okay, everybody, if you take a look at the psukim at the pasuk. Everybody have it? Vayetze harishon admoni kulo, and the, I'm sorry, again. Vayetze harishon admoni, and the first one came out ruddy. Kulo ka'aderet se'ar, he was all like a hairy cloak. Vayikru shmo Esav, and they called his name Esav. Everybody saw him and said, hu asui, he's a made thing. They named him Esav, same letters. And afterwards, his brother came out. Esav, and his hand was grasping Esav's heel. And he called his name Yaakov. Rashi says either that was God naming Yaakov or it was Yitzchak. And Yitzchak was 60 years old when he gave birth to, when they were born. Okay. Now, if you go back to the Sfarno, you go back to the Rashi, the fact that he's grasping his brother's heel is an indication or is a reason that he's given the name Yaakov. And the Ha'amek Davar gives an interesting explanation of that. And the Alshich, who is a Rishon, he's much earlier. It gives a different explanation, which I think will be very interesting. Okay. V'yado ochezet ba'akev Esav. His hand, Yaakov's hand, was grasping Esav's heel. L'shtei hara'ot. To teach two things. Im yehe b'shiflut, or for it can be read in as having a dual meaning, right? Im yehe b'shiflut uv'galut. If he will be in a low state and in exile. Yehi ritzono liyot nimshach acharav yoter mi l'sha'ar umot ha'olam. Yaakov's desire will be to be connected more with Esav than with the rest of the nations of the world. In other words, the Hamek Davar is saying Yaakov, and I find this sort of interesting, and not only at historical level, but I think in terms of the whole relationship between the brothers, and I'm sort of extrapolating from what the Netziv says, Yaakov, you could read his clinging to his brother's heel also as a desire for connection. When Yaakov's at the bottom, he cleaves to Esav. That's what, when he's in a state of, in a low state, or in he's in Galut, he's going to want to follow Esav more than other nations. Kidita Begitin, Perek Bet, Yud Zayin Amud Aleph. O bitulcha, o bitula devar Esav. It is a discussion there in Gitin where somebody is talking about the Persians, right? The Persians are not descended from Esav, and the Persians are, they come into the Beit Midrash and they turn out the lights, basically, something like that. It's a little discussion there, which we don't need the details of. And one of the people sitting in the Beit Midrash says, oh, you guys who live in Babel, you guys, you Babylonians, you're really like, you totally messed up here. If you're going to be in Galut, it is better that you be in your own shadow, or rather, if you can't be on your own land, you can't be in your own shadow, then you should be in the shadow of the sons of Esav, right? In other words, that there is still, Esav has some sort of, you have some sort of common grounds with Esav. Now, that's the Gemara. And what the Netziv is saying here is the grasping at the heel, Yaakov's behind, Esav is ahead. Yaakov would rather be connected to Esav than to other nations of the world. That's the first way to read the symbolism of what's happening there. The Kashel Yehe Berom HaMa'ala, but when Yaakov is at a high level, when Yaakov is in, is on the, you know, on top, Harehu Kimo Ochez Beregel Chavero Shelo Yelech Hala. He is like someone who grasps his friend's leg so that his friend can't go forward. Kach Moneahu Gdulat Esav Shelo Yitgaber Biyotel. Thus, Yaakov prevents the greatness of Esav so that he cannot become even stronger. So the Hamek Davar reads it as a sort of complex symbol. There are states in which Yaakov is grasping the heel sort of to catch up almost, right? And there are states in which Yaakov is grasping the heel to prevent Esav from rising. And I think that part of what's sort of being described here, and we're going to see this motif repeated later when we talk about the, if we have time to talk about the fact that Yaakov and Esav are twins, they shared a womb, and they are interconnected. So much so that the symbolism of that gets played out in a variety of different historical settings and even in halachic settings. The idea of the Seir la'Azazel, the scapegoat, and the goat that is sacrificed in the Beit HaMikdash is seen as, they are seen as symbols for Yaakov and Esav. So there is a kind of, I would say, and this is simplifying, a kind of love-hate connection between these brothers. They're still brothers. They have an uneasy relationship, but there is a connection between them. Yaakov's hand connects them, whether for the good or for the opposite. Okay. Now, the Torah and Moshe, Rav Moshe Alshich, who is a Mekubal, he's a Kabbalist, but he's also, I think we've looked at Alshich together in some of our classes prior to this. He's also very much a Pashtan. He's very much a person who asks the kinds of questions Rashi or the Ramban would ask about how the text is written, about the significance of things. He pays attention to grammar and details like that. He gives a very, very interesting reading here. Okay. And if we go back to the Pasuk, what the Pasuk says is, he comes out and his hand is holding His hand is holding, grasping his brother's heel, right? And it says, in the same verse, it says, and afterwards his brother came out and his hand was grasping his Esav's heel. Vayikra shemo Yaakov, and he called his name Yaakov. Now, it doesn't say Al Kain kara shemo Yaakov. It doesn't say therefore he called his name Yaakov. But the otherwise the words here are sort of a non sequitur. The proximity of the naming to the phenomenon of the heel for the Al Sheikh seems to indicate that there's a connection, that there's a connection between. And of course, the name itself, Yaakov, which literally means he will follow, right? Okay, so let's, he goes on and says the following. Hine kemo, let me do it, see if I can do it like this. Hine kemo zar nechshad. And here it is, it seems strange to think, he's paraphrasing a pasuk from Hosea, but what he's saying is, it seems strange to think, Sha'al ochez akev esav yikare shmo Yaakov. That Yaakov's name would be called Yaakov because he's holding on to Esav's heel. That's a funny reason to give for the naming of a child, right? Esav is self-evidently a sui. He's a maid. He's a very well-cooked baby, so to speak, right? And so Esav, a sui, that makes sense. But why name Yaakov after the fact that he is holding his brother's heel? He's grasping his brother's heel. Shehu davar bilti ikari. This is something non-essential, he's saying. It's not the main point. You know, when we give it, this is an opportunity to think about when we give babies names, there are all sorts of reasons why we give babies names. Sometimes the names are in memory of somebody, or sometimes the names are aspirational, what we hope for the baby. Sometimes the names are aesthetic. We like the way the name sounds. There are lots of reasons to give a baby a name. The fact that he was tangled up with his brother at birth seems like a strange reason to name him Yaakov. V'gam kol ha-Torah yipale lemat tisaper lanu inyan zeh. And he says it's also a little strange that the Torah bothers to tell us this thing, right? You know, when we see the births of babies in Tanakh, as a rule, we don't know the details, right? Like, this is not a midwife's convention where you sit around or mothers talking about their birth experiences. Oh, and this happened and that happened. And you know how the baby came out and what did the midwife say and what did the, right? We don't, you know, the Torah doesn't generally give us this kind of detail. The end of the pasuk says, and he says, how is this connected to the statement that Yitzchak was 60 years old when they were born? In other words, all these three details are put into the same pasuk and into the same verse, and they seem disconnected. V'gam, and also, ma bal hodienu, what is it coming to teach us? Achine amru razal. But here we see that in Chazal, we have a story, Nagada. Sha'al hegmon echan et Raban Gamliel, mi tofes hamalchut acharenu. So, and a Roman ruler, a Roman governor asked Raban Gamliel, who's going to seize the throne after us? If you think about the Romans, you know, had an empire, and the empire was, you know, like all empires, eventually was going to fall apart. And so the ruling governor says to Rabban Gamliel, who's going to be the next Malchut? Who's going to be the next, who's going to seize power after us? Katavlo, he wrote to him, V'yado ochezet ba'akev Esav. He says to the governor, and Yaakov's hand was grasping Esav's heel. Okay. By the way, the Roman Empire was a really powerful empire. The Romans claimed descent from Esav, and they looked like they were going to go on forever. They had conquered most of the known world, or certainly made inroads in conquering most of the known world. And he says to Rabban Gamliel, what happens when we fall? And Rabban Gamliel says, then we rise. Okay. Uvazeni be'el hanyan, he besom lev el omer Yaakov velo akav lashon abav. And in this, Rabban Gamliel prophesied to the matter that we should pay attention to, which is the pasuk says, Yaakov, he will follow, velo akav. It doesn't say he followed lashon avar in the past tense. And if we're thinking about describing the events happening in the birth, what should it say? His name was Akav. He followed, right? So why he will follow? Ahuki ba katuv latetuv tam el hibaleid esav rishon velo Yaakov. But this is because the scripture comes to give us a good reason for Esav's birth first and not Yaakov. And here's the big, you know, if you've ever taught the Yaakov Esav story to children, but even now to children, you know, why did Esav have to be the Bechor? Why did Esav have to be the firstborn? Why? It would have solved a lot of problems, or so we would be inclined to think, had Yaakov been the firstborn. And we're going to return to this issue again, because when it comes to the selling of the birthright, this is like a major, major issue. Why does Yaakov have to buy the birthright? What does it mean to buy the birthright? Why couldn't Yaakov simply have been born first? Like, if I were God, nobody's consulting me. That's the way I would have planned it. Isn't that the way we would like to think it would have happened? By the way, birth order is something completely controlled by God, obviously. V'hu me'ein ha-katuv l'mala. And this is something like something it is written earlier. I will come back to what he means. V'hinyan ki lama sha'olam hazeh hu hachanam. I'm sorry, let me start again. V'hinyan ki, and the matter is, ki lama sha'olam hazeh hu hachana el ha'olam haba. Okay? The matter is that this world is preparation for the world to come. Al kein, hu hakodem. That's why it comes first, right? Olam hazeh, this world, the world we inhabit, comes first. Kasher katavnu al vahi erev vahi boker, ki erev kodem liyoto remez el olam hazeh. Okay, so here, the Alshich is referring to a very beautiful piece of Torah, the beginning of Genesis, where he says the following. I taught this recently in a course I'm giving on Parshat Bereshit, which I had prepared before this whole horrible war broke out, and it became very apt all of a sudden. It's sort of very interesting. This is a big question that we have in general, I think, about why the Jewish day starts at night, right? Vayi erev, vayi boker, yom echad, right? Or yom sheni, or yom shlishi. Evening comes before morning. And by the way, one of the things that's detailed as existing before creation is choshech, darkness. The Alshech analyzes those first few psukim, the first few verses of Parshat Bereshit in a very, very interesting way. And he says, God places night or darkness first, and day comes after, or when we think of the day starts at night and then goes to the morning and then returns to night. To hint to us, to the Jewish people, that this world, the darkness, is a world of imperfection in which the righteous suffer and in which things don't always go the way they're supposed to go or how we'd want them to go. To hint to us that this world comes before the world to come, or the suffering comes before the reward, or the dark stuff comes before the light. And if you think about it spiritually and maybe psychologically as well, one of the things that I think we notice is that Jews tend to be optimistic in the sense that they're very life affirming, right? Jews always, you know, rebuild, right? We got kicked out of here. We rebuild over there. Even now, I mean, to use a contemporary example, which I'm using with great, Yirat Kavod with great respect, people are already talking about going back to those kibbutzim in the surrounding area of Gaza and rebuilding, right? People after the Holocaust got married, had children, even though they saw what could happen to their children. That's the basic orientation of the Jewish people, I think, is optimistic. And I think that it's almost as though, this is without learning the Al-Sheikh, without actually understanding the Al-Sheikh or studying this question, the Jewish day starts in the darkness, but we always know the morning is going to come, right? It goes to the light. We move from darkness to light. Okay. Now, if we say, as the Al-Sheikh will say extensively here and elsewhere, that Esav gets this world. Esav rules in this world. Esav gets this world. But we get the world to come. And we're going to see that issue comes up when we talk about the selling of the Bechora. Esav will triumph in this world, and that's the darkness, that's the night. And as we head toward morning, Yaakov will triumph. In other words, Yaakov is behind Esav, just as the day follows the night, right? And that is symbolic of their different positions in the world order and in history. Okay, so let's go back to the source. It disappeared on me. Hang on, share screen. And the Al-Sheikh goes on and says the following. We start with Olam Hazem, v'achalkach boker shehu or ha'olam haba, and afterwards comes the morning, which is the light of the world to come. V'al derech zeh, and in this manner, hinei Esav chelko ba'olam hazeh, v'yaakov lo'olam haba. And here, Esav's portion is this world, and Yaakov's is the world to come. Ukimo she'amru razal, as Chazal said, she'chilkum min ha'beten. They divided them from the womb. Esav natal ha'olam hazeh, Esav takes this world, and therefore he would run, he would struggle, he would try to get out, that's the Rashi, when they passed houses of idol worship. Ki me'echuta haya, because he was of that quality, meaning he was essentially of that type, and so he was pulled toward Avodah Zarah. This is the same midrash that Rashi quotes, but what the Al-Sheikh is doing is he's explaining it rather than quoting it. The Yaakov ha'olam haba. Yaakov is the world to come. Val kein zot nechmat b'nei Yaakov be'onyam. And therefore, this is the comfort of the b'nei Yaakov in their suffering. Ki Esav notel chelko rishona. Esav takes his portion first. And afterwards, Yaakov will take his portion. This is what the pasuk says. Afterwards, his brother came out. V'lo haya rishon ki hu hakadosh. And he doesn't come out first because he's the Holy One, and he is not now the firstborn. Halohu nirmaz b'mas sheyado ochezet ba'akev Esav. Is this not hinted in the fact that he is holding Esav's heel? Ki chelko v'tuvo hu because his portion and the good that will come to him is in the wake of Esav and the end of the goodness of Esav. Hanotel rishona shehu ba'olam hazeh. Who takes first which is this world. Va'al ken, vayikra shemo Yaakov. And therefore, Yitzchak called him Yaakov. He will follow. Not he followed now when he came out of the womb grasping Esav's heel, but he will follow Yaakov, Esav throughout history. Lomal, to say, Shezenotel Ekev Esav hu al hatid. That is that the pasuk is telling us that he takes the heel of Esav is talking not about this, the circumstances of his birth, but rather about the future. She Yaakov ki achel tuvo ba'achrona b'ikvot Esav. That Yaakov, the good that will come to him will be delayed to the end after Esav. Okay, and now he says something interesting, which is going to have implications for the rest of the story between the brothers. V'shema tomar, and if you will say, mi higid li Yitzchak me'ata kol zeh, who told Yitzchak all of this? V'gam, and also, kasher kara shem li Yaakov, when he named Yaakov, lama lo kara shem la zeh, shem, and when he named Yaakov, why doesn't he name Esav? Okay, so he's now asking two further questions. He says, wait a minute, this is, my theory is really very cool here and everything, and it's beautiful, and it's theologically satisfying, and it's, you know, answers the question of why it says Yaakov in the future tense and not in the past tense. He says, but wait a minute, how did Yitzchak know all this? In other words, we know that Rivka knows something of this, right? Rivka understands something of this because she received a message from God to the effect that the elder would serve the younger and that there are two nations in her belly and that there's the struggle between them is they're going to be in a struggle. That makes sense. But how did Yitzchak know this? And also, while we're at it, why doesn't he name Esav? Why doesn't it say? Esav is born and we get the physical description of Esav and then, and Yaakov, Yitzchak named him Esav. No, he only names Yaakov. Lazea mao, that's, for this reason it says, the text says, V'Yitzchak ben Shishim Shana v'gomer, that Yitzchak was 60 years old. Shehu b'meitav haskalato, he was at the height of his intellectual powers. And the days of his old age came in which his knowledge is gathered to him. In other words, Yitzchak, as opposed to what some sort of more modern readings of this text claim, Yitzchak is 60 years old, which means he still has the cognitive capacity, and even more so, he has the wisdom of old age. Esav Yitzchak is at the height of his powers, so to speak. Ba'ofen shelo yivatzer mimenu ruach hakodesh la'avchin bein tzadik v'larasha. In a manner which meant that the divine spirit was not withheld from him for him to understand or to distinguish between tzadik and rasha. Al kein me'ata yikir ha'emet. Therefore, from now, from this point, we see that he knew the truth. B'kara shem la tzadik v'lo l'rasha. He named the tzadik and not the rasha. V'yada ki zechel ko ha'olam hazeh v'zeh ha'olam haba. And he knew that this son, his portion was this world, and that son, his portion was the world to come. And then he's going on. He says, I'm going to go on and explain this further when it comes to the brachot is, when he re-explores this. So what we have happening here is this, Yitzchak, Rivka knows what she knows about the sons because she's had a warning or a divine message, which sort of primes her to understand what's involved in the raising of these two children. But Yitzchak, according to the Al-Sheikh, sees it through the eye of Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. And here I'm just going to give you a little bit of a sense of what's critical here. We have, if you're reading like the Al-Sheikh, you're going to have a little bit of a problem with the whole idea of Yitzchak loving Esav more than he loves Yaakov, right? That, and or why does he want to give him the bechorah and the blessings, or the blessings more accurately? The bechorah is something you're born with, right? You don't even Yitzchak cannot confer the birthright on either of his sons. That's either you're born the bechor or you're not born the bechor. But he wants to give the blessings to Esav, and that seems to be paradoxical if we read like the Alshich. And I think here, I just want to say back last week when we started talking, I said, well, really, if we had time, we would start with an understanding of who Yitzchak is, because Yitzchak and Rivka are the key to understanding Yaakov and Esav in many, many ways. And we're going to talk about this more, as I said, when we get to the Brachot, but Yitzchak of all the Avot is probably the most internal and the holiest in the sense that he himself was a sacrifice to God. He lay himself on the altar at the age of 37, prepared to hand himself over to God. His service of God involves gvura. Gvura is self-control, it's power, it's spirit, great spiritual power. And Yitzchak is not deceived by Esav. And we're going to have to account for this, or why does he favor Esav? We're going to have to account for this by looking more deeply at the tension between the brothers. Okay, so the tension between the brothers starts when Vayigdalu Hana'arim. Okay, so we're going to look at these psukim now together. So we're back in Bereishit Chaf Hei. That's Genesis 25. And it is immediately after the birth. Chaf Zayin, 27. Genesis 25, 27. Chaf Hei, Chaf Zayin. Everybody have it? Vayigdelu ha'ne'arim, and the lads grew up. Vayhi Esav ish yodea tzayit ish sadeh. And Esav was a man who knew hunting, a man of the field. V'Yaakov ish tam, and Yaakov was a wholehearted person, a simple person. There are a lot of ways to translate this. Yoshev ohalim, dweller in tents, a dweller in tents. Yitzchak et Esav b'fiv, and Yitzchak loved Esav because hunting was in his mouth. Ohevet Yaakov, and Rivka loves Yaakov. Okay, that's the two psukim that we're going to focus on now, and let's start by looking at the Rashi here. Now, Rashi is sort of, I think, relating to Vayigdelu HaNe'arim. Vayigdelu HaNe'arim, the lads grew up, and Esav, in English we'd say, became a man who knows hunting, a man of the field. Okay, and Yaakov is a wholehearted man who dwells in tents. I think Rashi's wondering why we need, of course they grew up, right? So why tell us, and the lads grew up, which like we would figure that out, right? We don't need that statement. So Rashi explains the following. Kol zman shehayu ktanim, as long as they were young, little, lo hayu nikarim b'maaseihem, they were not recognized by their deeds. Ve'ein adam midakdek b'hem mativam, and nobody could pay attention closely to what their different qualities were. Kevan shenasu b'nei 13 shana, when they were 13, then when they became 13 years old, ze perash levatei midrashot, v'ze perash la'avodah zarah. This one peeled off toward houses of study, and this one separated himself to idol worship. Right. So what's vayigdalu hana'arim? Pretty much. There's no radical difference between Yaakov and Esav when they're young. Little boys are little boys, maybe. You know, little kids are little kids. Sometimes they're, when you see a little boy do something cruel or violent, you don't think he's evil. You think he's a little boy, right? In fact, there's an interesting midrash, which I haven't brought here, that says that that's the mistake that Yitzchak makes. Yitzchak gives them exactly the same education. He didn't realize that they needed very different kinds of upbringing, two different temperaments, and they needed different kinds of upbringing. And by the way, we learn the halacha here because it says when they were 13 years old, they stop being called little kids anymore. That's why we make the bracha, Baruch shepitarani me'on sho shel zeh, blessed is God who has released me from the punishment for my children's actions at the age of 13 for boys and 12 for girls. Okay. Now, Rashi is also troubled by this phrase, yodea tsayid. What would we expect it to say? Knowing hunting. Ish yodea tsayid. A man knowing hunting. What would the word be that we would expect here? Vayi Esav, and Esav was Sayad, a hunter. That's what we would expect it to say, right? We would also expect it to say about Yaakov, Vayi Yaakov ro'e tzon. Yaakov became a shepherd. It doesn't say what we expect in these, in the description of these brothers in the pasuk. What does it mean to know hunting? And Rashi explains, Latsu de l'ramot et aviv b'fiv, to hunt and to trick his father with his mouth. V'sho'alo, and he would ask him, Abba, he'ach ma'asrin et ha'melech ve'et melach ve'et ha'teven. How do you tithe salt and straw? Okay. The answer is you don't tithe salt and straw. Okay. Kisavur aviv shehu mitzvot. His father thought that he was stringent in keeping mitzvot. Now, Rashi's reading, which is taken from Tanhuma, definitely contradicts the approach taken by the Alshech, right? In other words, in Rashi's reading, the reason that Yitzchak favors Esav is because he thinks Esav is something other than he actually is. And not only in Tanhuma, there is a basis for this in several Midrashim in Bereishit Rabbah. So again, we're going to hold those two pictures in our heads at the same time. On one view, Yitzchak knows exactly who Esav is, and nonetheless, he loves him and he wants to give him the blessings. On the other view, Yitzchak doesn't really know who Esav is. He gives him the benefit of the doubt, or he assumes him to be much more virtuous than he is. And he gives him the blessings. Then we have to account for why he gives him the blessings. Any ideas here? Why does he give him the blessings? Or why does he want to give him the blessings?
He's the Bachar.
He needs the Bechor. And that's where. And there's going to be a tension in our reading. He's the firstborn. There's going to be a tension in our reading. And really, all of the approaches to this are on one side or the other. Is the desire to give the blessings in Yitzchak's illusions about Esav? Or more accurately, is Yitzchak's desire to give the blessings to Esav a function of his punctiliousness in obeying God? And I think that that's a very important distinction. In other words, Yitzchak is the man of law. He's din, right? He is judgment. He accepts God's judgment. He is gvura. He is an internal strength. He is the person who will do as God wishes him to do. If Esav is born first, what does that mean? That means God wants Esav to be the firstborn, which means I, Yitzchak, may not get it, right? I may not agree with it. I may not understand it, but clearly God has chosen Esav for whatever reason. And again, once again, a better understanding of Yitzchak will help us see it that way. Okay, Marilyn, I'll take one question now because I really want to go back to the Mikoro. Go ahead.
Just what you said, on the one hand, that Yitzchak understood his character, and he wasn't fooled by him, but he still loved him. Now, I'm not talking about the Bechorah, but it says he loved him. He loved him.
We're going to look at that.
What was
We're going to look at that. Again, either he look, either way, Esav is the Bechor, like fair is
right?
fair.
Okay.
But why does
Right.
he? We're going to look at that pasuk as well. The simple answer, the very simple answer, is Yitzchak loves Esav because he's his son. Right? You can love a child who's a bad child. But we're going to talk about that more. It comes up over and over again in the Mefarshim. I also want to point out something else here. Wait, there was something else in my head. Let's go on. It'll come to me and or not. But let's go on. Okay.
Excuse me. Also, Aesop feeds him. He
Oh, no.
shows, yes,
No,
there's
we're
something
going to talk
very.
about that. We're going to talk about that in a minute. That's the comparison between the love of one parent and the love of the other. I was going to say something else that I have found very, very intriguing and interesting and important in understanding this story. Whatever else Esav may be, one of the things that emerges very clearly from this story is that he loved his father. His love for his father, if there's anybody in the world that Esav cares about, it's his father. And that's not an accident either. That has some role to play here. And we see that because one indication of that, at least, and there are others, is he says, Hedda, would you please mute yourself? He
Yes.
says, I will wait till my father dies and then I'm going to kill my brother. Right? He does care about his father. He does want his father's approval. He even the fact that he tries to deceive his father is in a sense because he wants his father's approval. I think that's if we want to look for, and Chazal, by the way, say that Bnei Esav are better at kibud av va'em than Bnei Yisrael, right? They're better at honoring their elders than Bnei Yisrael. Okay, so let's go back to the text and the Mikorot. Okay, so let's go on. Okay, so hang on, let me just find it here. Ish Sadeh. Okay, so on Rashi's reading, Yitzchak is deceived by Esav. What does Ish Sadeh mean? What does a man of the field mean? Kimashmao, as it sounds. A man who works in a field, right? And Rashi, it reads it as a negative description of Esav. Adam batel, a person who is unemployed in the sense of who isn't working, v'tzodeh b'kashto chayot v'ofot, and he hunts with his bow and arrow, wild animals and birds. What that means is, I mean, if you think about, and this is part of, I think, a larger understanding of how professions are viewed in Tanakh, hunters wait around a lot, right? What do? They go out, they track the animal, and then they wait around a lot, or they wait around for the snare to go off or the trap to go off, and then they come and they take the animal. So hunting involves a lot of time, but it doesn't involve a lot of industry. It doesn't involve work as such. So Rashi sees the statement, a man of a field, not man of the field, not a guy who's into nature, but rather somebody who spends a lot of time empty-handed in the field. Esav is not a farmer. Esav is a hunter. And hunters get a bad rap in Tanakh. Tanakh prefers farmers and shepherds. Okay. And we could see why. I mean, civilization is built from, sowing fields, growing crops, tending flocks. Hunting is a much more, unstable kind of, creates a more unstable, more nomadic kind of society. Now the word tam. Yaakov Ishtam. Yaakov was a tam man. What does tam mean? I translate it as wholehearted. Rashi says, Eino baki b'chol ele. He was not an expert in all these things. Kilibo kein piv. As his heart was, thus his mouth. Mi she'eino charif l'ramot karui tam. Somebody who is not sharp at tricking other people is called tam. That's where you get the translation of simple. A simple person, you know, the person who can be easily tricked but doesn't know how to trick other people. And of course, this is highly ironic in terms of what happens later between the brothers and between Yaakov and Yitzchak with respect to the blessings. Yoshev Ohalim, a dweller of tents. And here again, Rashi's saying, what do you mean a dweller of tents? What about a dweller of a tent dweller, right? One, not tents. Ohalo shel shem, ohalo shel ever. The tent of shem and the tent of ever. And this is, Rashi takes the dwelling in tents to be this person who seeks wisdom. And he's, again, this is based on a midrash. Person who seeks wisdom, who seeks scholarship, who seeks learning. Yaakov is not spending his time out there in the field running around and wasting time for a lot of the time. He's a person who is pursuing knowledge and wisdom and spirituality. Okay. And then Rashi says, let's go to the Pasuk Yud Chaf. Pasuk Chaf Chet. Because this is where we come to the what's going on with the parents issue. Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav, ki tzayid b'fiv, Genesis 25:28, and Yitzchak loved Esav because hunting was in his mouth. V'rivka ohevet et Yaakov, and Rivka loves Yaakov. Okay? Now, there are a couple of things here to notice, but what does Rashi pick up on here? Hunting was in his mouth. And Rashi's question is, whose mouth? Whose mouth had the hunting? Okay, so the Targum, which is the translation of Onkelos, right, says, B'fiv shel Yitzchak. Yitzchak loves Esav because the stuff that Esav hunted was in Yitzchak's mouth, right? Umidrasho, and the midrash is, Befiv shel Esav, the hunting was in Esav's mouth. Esav used his mouth to hunt. Shehayat sadoto umirameu bidvarav. He hunted down his father and tricked him with his words. Now, the Rashi's question actually makes a lot of sense, because if we were writing this pasuk, which we don't get to do, we would expect it to say something like, Ve'ahav Yitzchak et Esav, ki echiloto, ki ochel b'fiv, where he gave him food. We wouldn't expect it to be hunting was in his mouth. So those are the two possible ways of reading it. Okay. The Sfarno reads it differently. The Sfarno takes a different tack here. He says the following. Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav, and Yitzchak loved Esav, gam et Esav. He loved also Esav. Afal pi sheyada b'li safek shelo haya shalem ki Yaakov. Even though he undoubtedly knew that Esav was not as wholehearted or whole, perfect as Yaakov. V'rivka ohevet et Yaakov, and Rivka loved Yaakov, livado, alone. Mipneshe, hikira b'risho shel Esav, she loved Yaakov alone because she recognized the wickedness of Esav. Now, if we try to reconstruct the thinking of the Sfarno, it could be, the Sfarno's thinking, I'm starting to sound like a Bible translation. If we try to reconstruct the Sfarno's thinking, it could be that what impels the Sfarno to read this way is that is that it says, Vayehav et Esav ki, right? He loved Esav because, right? As opposed to Rivka loves Yaakov without any qualifying reason. No, there's no reason that's given here. So on, also on the Sfarnos reading, like the Alshifs, Yitzchak knows full well who Esav is, and nonetheless, he loves him. Okay. Even though he's not as perfect. Okay. We're going to skip these redacts for a moment. Okay. The redact sort of, this piece of the redact we'll read here. Well, let me stop the share for a moment. To say that, we talk about a favorite child, which we're not supposed to have, and we talk about stuff like that, right? We talk about, Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel gam et Rachel mi Leah, right? Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. But the assumption is he also loved Leah, right? It's not that he didn't love Leah. He loved Rachel more, which is why you're not supposed to have more than one wife. It is human nature that the relationship's going to be different. Don't try this at home, folks, okay? But when it comes to children, we hope to have many more than one child, right? So when we're talking about children, we can assume, your starting assumption is going to be that both parents love both children. In the Sfarnos reading, Rivka doesn't love Esav, right? In the Radak's reading, they both love both children, but one favors one over the, I'm sorry, not the Red, the Sfarno says she doesn't love Esav at all because he's wicked. And in the other reading, it's that she loves Esav too, but she loves Yaakov more or more truly. And here, the Sfarno, I think, and not the Sfarno, sorry, the Radak, I keep doing that, Radak, and then I'll take questions. We'll stop for some questions. The Radak says the following, which I find kind of interesting. The pasuk doesn't have to tell us that he loved Yaakov. He loved Yaakov more than Esav. And he did not love Esav except because he brought hunting to feed him. Zeu she'amal. Sorry, it did it again. Zeu sha'amar, this is what the text says, b'fiv. He loved him with his mouth, in his mouth. His mouth made him love Esav. Uvasar hatzayit hayam mut'am, the meat that he hunted was tasty to him. Okay. So again, we're going to see the relationship between the parents and the children here is more complex. We'll continue with the Torah, the Alshech here next week and the Or HaChaim. We have a lot here. Okay. We're going to stop here because I want to take questions, before we end the Shi'ur. Okay. Any questions? You can raise your hand by pressing something on your screen. Anybody have anything you want to ask? Yeah. Is that you, Marilyn? Did you want to ask something? You have to unmute yourself. I can't hear you. I can't hear you. You have to unmute yourself.
I did. I said, I put in the chat that I thought Tom might be genuine, that not only wholesome, but he was genuine. What was in his heart was in his mouth.
Rashi said. By the way, I just am going to reiterate that I don't read chat. I can't handle chat.
And the
sources.
All right.
So if anybody has a question in the chat that they want to, that's what Rashi says. What was in his heart, what was in his mouth, was what.
So I would define it as genuine, not simple. But anyway, so according to Radak, that he really, it's funny that he would say that. Yitzchak only liked Esav
Because
because
of
the
the
food he
food.
gave him.
Yeah, so
Yeah,
there,
that
I think
seems pretty
what's
valid.
going to be very interesting about this is when you get to the Rashi on the giving of the brachot, and we're not gonna have time to go through all of the Rashis. Yitzchak is the last person in the world to be a gourmet, right? To be a person interested in food per se. And certainly in the view of Chazal, Yitzchak is far more otherworldly than not. But I think we
Right.
could still read it. We could still read it in this way, and I'll tell you why. As the Al Sheikh is going to tell us, the Or HaChaim and the Al Sheikh in their own ways both tell us, and I think next time I'll just sort of synopsize them so that we can go on to the next section. Esav is a better son than Yaakov, because Esav is a more attentive son than Yaakov. It is not
Okay.
so much the food as that Esav, thinks about, maybe I'll bring this for father, maybe he'll want to eat this. He wants to spend more time with him. He wants his approval, right? Because the love here is Avat HaMo'il, as one of them says, the love of that which is helpful to us. But it's also kind of natural. Sometimes you may love both your children or all 10 of your children, but there's one son who takes care of you, and there is built into that a kind of satisfaction and a reciprocal feeling of gratitude for the son who wants to take care of you. I think there's also one of the Midrashim talks about the reason that Yitzchak becomes blind is because he took bribes from Esav. And when you take the bribe of the meat from Esav, it blinds you, right? The idea that shochad ya'aver enei pikrim. So a student of mine had a very interesting chiddush on that, that broke out this argument in the classroom once. Said, how can the Midrash say that about Yitzchak, that he was blinded by Esav's treats or whatever it is? And one of my students, with great maturity and understanding, said, it's his son. He wants to believe that he's good. He wants Esav to be a good person. And anything that is going to be evident, that's shochad, it's true. But we're all like that. Even a great tzaddik, even somebody who is very clear-sighted, we want our children to be good. We want to find the best in them. It's easy to be bribed by that. It's not a bribe in the coarse, ugly way that somebody gave me something, therefore I favor them. Yitzchak would love for both of his sons to be good, and any evidence of Esav's goodness is something that he's going to cherish, and it's going to feed his love, and that makes a lot of sense. Jane Austen says mothers are the most, they'll swallow anything. You tell them anything good about their kids, they'll believe you. We all know that. We want to see only the best in our children, right? And in this respect, Yitzchak is a father, right? Okay, any other questions before we move on, before we close down? Okay, so next week, Bezrat Hashem, we will sort of hurry through the remaining mikorot. You have them in front of you in case you want them. They will be posted because Natalie wasn't able to post them today. And we'll start the next section, which is the sale of the Bechorah, which is fascinating. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, bye.
Thank you.
Have a nice rest of your
Thank
day.
you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank